Bonjour, mesdames et messieurs. It's really a great honor for me to present in this lecture series. I'm very grateful indeed to Professor Bouchot for his invitation. The title of my lecture will be The Complex Dynamics of Financial Prices. And as you will see, it's rather similar in content to the lecture that Professor Bouchot has already given. And I think there's a good reason for this, and that is our points of view are rather similar, and the topic is very similar. So here's an outline of my talk. First of all, I'll talk about the nature of trading. What is trading, and how does it give rise to complex price patterns? And then I'll talk about options. I'll explain what options are, and explain how options can be used as experimental tools to study the dynamics of the underlying price series. And then this will get us eventually to the Black-Scholes model. I will try to minimize the use of formulae and so on. Nevertheless, I'll just project up the Black-Scholes model so that you can see what the formula looks like. And then I'll introduce the concept of implied volatility and draw the volatility surface. And then we'll see how we naturally get to stochastic volatility, everything this time driven by trading. In other words, the fact that traders need to minimize their minimize the volatility of their profit and loss when they trade options. So this leads us to stochastic volatility, and because of the deficiencies of traditional stochastic volatility models, eventually this will lead us to rough volatility. But again, the recurrent theme here is that prices have complex dynamics that result from trading, and option trading is one of the trading styles that gives rise to these complex dynamics. So there are many ways to approach an understanding of the world in which we live. And, you know, we're talking about the real world here, in particular the world of finance. So we can approach this understanding as a physicist, look at the time series, try to come up with models that describe the time series. As a mathematician, you come up with some axioms that are more or less reasonable under the circumstances and try to deduce what you can deduce, to prove some theorems. As an economist, try to say, okay, in equilibrium, what should everybody be doing? Take into account transaction costs and so on and so forth. But in this talk, I will try to approach the world of finance from the point of view of a trader. I was a trader in the distant past, and I still trade from time to time personally. So I'm going to look at things from the point of view of an options trader. And we'll see later why it's interesting to look at things from the point of view of an options trader. So what is a trader? Well, a trader buys and sells financial assets. And traditionally, traders are either hedgers, speculators, or arbitrageurs. But we'll see, actually, there's no neat split into these various buckets. A hedger can be viewed as a speculator can be viewed as a hedger, depending on your point of view. Today, trading is overwhelmingly automated and electronic. Today's trader programs and monitors computer algorithms. So, for example, my students at Baruch, they almost invariably go into the financial industry, and there many of them are traders, but when they say they're traders, they spend all their time programming and monitoring execution algorithms. So here's a picture of old style trading. It's a modern picture. This pit still exists, the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange, but there isn't really much trading done there in terms of volume of shares changing hands. It's really not much. And you can see it's a bunch of people talking to each other. But as I say, this is old style. This is the new style of trading. This is an option market making company from Amsterdam, and this is a picture of their Chicago office. And you can see a bunch of guys, no girls as far as I can tell, a bunch of guys, and they look like computer programmers. And indeed they are. They're programming algorithms, and they're monitoring the algorithms as they trade. So trading algorithms perform the functions of hedger, speculator, and arbitrageur all at once. I mean, if there ever was an arbitrage, what is arbitrage? Arbitrage is a trade that makes you money for sure. Well, naturally, since it's algorithms trading with each other, the chances of finding an arbitrage, in other words, a for sure way of making money, are almost infinitesimal. And so these algorithms operate in such a way that arbitrage is essentially eliminated. However, they have to hedge these algorithms, because as you trade, you build inventory, and you want to minimize the random profit and loss that results just from the random movement in the underlyings. So your algorithm needs to be able to hedge. And the whole point of trading is to speculate. In other words, you need to be able to guess or predict what's going to happen next. So for example, one way of predicting what's going to happen next is to detect a trend in the underlying price series and just follow the trend. So that's pretty popular. Statistical arbitrage can say, well, for example, if you're looking at Bank of America and Citibank, they're two big banks in the US, they should move together. And if one of them moves up a lot and the other one doesn't move, then probably you should buy the one that didn't move up and sell the one that moved up. This kind of trading is called statistical arbitrage. Another kind of trading that you can do is market making. In other words, try and sell at the offer side of the market and buy on the bid side of the market. So basically making bids and offers all day, hoping to capture the spread between the high offer price and the low bid price. Well, when we say high and low, where these prices are very similar. So it's a very, very dangerous business, because you're making tiny amounts of money all the time with a risk of huge loss. So our picture of the market will be one of a game between competing algorithms. Each time an algorithm trades, it impacts the market price. A buy order tends to increase the price of the asset being traded, and a sell order tends to decrease the price. So that change in the price is detected by other algorithms that respond by trading, and so on for forever and ever. So for example, imagine Warren Buffett, famous trader. He has a very long holding period. Let's say his holding period is 10 to 20 years. And he buys in huge size and he sells in huge size. So every time he buys, he has to buy over a period of many, many days and weeks. And obviously, as he buys, he increases the price of the asset. And then other people see, well, for example, the price of these other assets that he didn't buy, they should be tracking the prices of the assets that he did buy, and they do statistical arbitrage or whatever. But it's on a much different time scale. They're planning to make money over a time scale of, let's say, a month or a couple of months. And as they trade, other people are going to say, well, okay, I see this price trend and so on and so forth, all the way down to the time scale of microseconds where the high frequency traders trade. So you've got a cascade of different times, trading games and played at different time scales. And this is what leads to our complex price dynamics. As we will see, there are wonderful patterns in prices that can be modeled mathematically. This mathematical beauty emerges from the complex interaction between thousands of trading algorithms, all trading on different timescales, as I just explained, all the way from Warren Buffett trading on a 20-year timescale to the high-frequency traders trading on timescales of microseconds. Now, it's important to understand that traders do not need to understand finance theory or mathematics to be able to trade profitably. So they don't need a master's in finance or a master's in financial engineering, although it helps. That many financial theorists seem to believe that traders need training in order to be able to trade. It's not necessary. To paraphrase Nassim Taleb, birds do not need ornithologists to teach them how to fly. So traders don't need us to teach them how to trade. A typical trading algorithm requires imagination. That's very important to come up with the idea. But then usually just simple tools like linear regression to come up with the parameters. And in fact, even linear regression can be a very sophisticated technique because it all depends what you regress against. You can regress against some fancy nonlinear function. So much to the chagrin of physicists, mathematicians, and economists, the real academics in this game, the only essential skill is computer programming. So basically, if you're in a hedge fund or a market maker or whatever, and you're a trader, everybody needs to be able to program a computer, but many people really don't understand that much about finance. So if scientists are not necessary for trading, what's the point of modeling? Well, mathematical models help us trade optimally, taking into account our portfolio and the history of prices. In other words, models help us maximize profits whilst minimizing risk. More generally, mathematical models are mathematics is a kind of language that helps us formulate our thoughts. So that's kind of philosophical. But in any case, for our purposes, mathematical models are just ways of managing risk. Traders become more comfortable handling risk. Spreads tighten. So when I talk about spread, remember I'm talking about the spread between the bid price, where you get to sell your stock, and the offer price, where you get to buy your stock, reducing transactions costs. And this itself is a feedback effect. Back to the topic of the lecture series, this is a feedback effect where scientists get to impact prices, because modeling does affect prices. As people become more comfortable with the behavior of the underlying and the behavior of the things being traded, they are willing to take more risk and tighten bid and offer spreads. So if trading's just a game between algorithmic traders, what's the point of markets? Well, it's fun. That's a good point. According to economic theory, though, one of the key functions of markets is to allocate resources efficiently. So from a trader's perspective, there are end users, not just traders in the market. For example, there are corporates who are raising capital for new initiatives or even IPO, so like selling shares for the first time. And there are long-term investors such as pension funds who are buying assets to hedge against long-term liabilities. Nevertheless, when you analyze the volume traded, most trading activity appears to be endogenous. Traders trading with other traders, trading algorithms trading with other trading algorithms. The complex game played by traders makes the process of resource allocation more efficient. Well, at least that's what we all hope. Now, having talked kind of philosophically about trading, let's talk about a particular price series, S&P. This is the one I always talk about. S&P is the biggest equity options market in the world, I believe. And so this is a graph that almost everybody listening to this lecture will have seen before. It's the time series of S&P since 1927. Well, first of all, this is a kind of scary picture, right? This picture of prices going up exponentially, and you wonder when they might collapse. Well, if you look at it on a logarithmic scale, it looks much more reasonably. And so I've added a trend line so that you can see roughly that on a logarithmic scale, prices are increasing just compound every year by about 4.5%. Of course, this excludes dividends that you get when you hold the index. So the total return of this thing is probably, I don't know, an average of 7.5% per annum or something, which is not so different from the return of bonds, but still different. So probably there is a little bit of so-called risk premium between bonds and equity. And why is there risk premium? Well, there's risk premium because you can see, well, sometimes you make a lot less, you could be unlucky and you could buy here and you could sell there and you would lose a lot of money. Hopefully you don't do this. And you could be very lucky, you could buy here and sell there. Either way, there is risk associated with buying equities rather than buying bonds. And so we, according to economic theory, there should be some premium associated with that. Now, as I mentioned earlier, options are excellent experimental tools to study the dynamics of underlying prices. And so when I say underlying, I really mean S&P for this lecture. So S&P is going to be our underlying. So what is an option? Well, a call option gives the holder the right, but not the obligation to buy stock at expiration. And in return for getting this option, so basically you're going to exercise the option if the price goes up, and you're going to not exercise the option if the price goes down. And with put options, which give the holder the right but not the obligation to sell stock, you're going to exercise the option if the price goes down, and you're not going to exercise the option if the price goes up. Since this is a kind of insurance, obviously you have to pay a premium for this right. And if the premium were zero, this would be an arbitrage, obviously. It would mean you would make money for nothing, because either the price goes up, in which case you make money, and then you didn't have to pay anything for it. If the price goes down, you don't lose anything. So that's an arbitrage. So clearly there has to be a premium. Here's an example of a typical strategy that a retail trader like me these days might employ, although I never do complicated strategies like this one, but it's a strategy that you might think of. And if you look at websites that teach you how to trade, they're always going to illustrate the condor. Well, what is a condor? A condor is long, let's say, a 90% strike put, short a 95% strike put, short a 105% strike call, and long a 110 strike call. I'll let you study the strategy later. But what's the point of this strategy? Well, you can see this strategy makes money if the underlying stays between 95% and 105% of its current level. So you may have the view the underlying is going to stay in this level, the market's going to be relatively quiet, nothing's going to happen to this particular underlying. And if you want to take that view, you might be willing to have this strategy on where you make money in that case. But on the other hand, with this strategy, you lose a lot of money if you're wrong. Nevertheless, the amount of money you lose is bounded. So you lose a bounded amount of money if you're wrong. So you lose a large amount of money if you're long, but not infinite amount of money if you're wrong. And on the other hand, if you're right, you make a small amount of money. A typical option strategy. So options have been traded for a very, very long time, at least since ancient Greek times. There's a story about real option trading in ancient Greece. We've got documentary evidence of this. There's a great book written about option trading in Amsterdam in the 17th century, expressing your market view using options, for example, this way, is a fun game, which can maybe even be profitable. However, for us, what's the main point of option trading? Analyzing the market pricing of options is a great way to discover properties of the underlying time series. Now, to see why, consider another trading strategy, a popular trading strategy called the butterfly. Well, what is a butterfly spread? For example, this one is long, a 95 strike option, short two at the money options. At the money means at the current spot. Long, a 105 strike option, and you can see the maximum payoff of the spread is one. And for this one, you have to pay a kind of chunky premium. Well, because the chance that the price is going to end up between 95 and 105 is kind of big. On the other hand, you could do another strategy that has a maximum payoff of one by buying a 99 strike put, selling two options at the money, buying a 101 strike call, and the premium for this is rather small. Well, because the probability of making money is rather small, because to make money, you have to be between 99 and 101 at the end. So you can see from these pictures, the option prices convey information about the distribution of the underlying. In other words, they tell you what's the probability of being in a certain range at expiration of the option. And if you look at all the options, they basically tell you what's the distribution of the underlying. Now, there's a story about risk neutral distribution and physical distribution, but I'm not going to go into the details of this thing. We'll just talk about distribution of the underlying. So basically, option prices tell you what the distribution of the underlying is going to be at expiration. And if you have options for all sorts of expirations, then basically you can tell the marginal distributions for different dates in the future. And if you have the collection of all marginal distributions for every date in the future, you can tell quite a lot about what the dynamics of the underlying must be. So the profitability of option traders depends on their assessing correctly the relative probabilities of different events. Again, we can discover these lots of properties by looking at option prices. Well, on the other hand, to be able to really understand what option prices tell us about the behavior of the underlying price, we need a model. So a model is like a way of using option prices. It's a way of interpreting option prices for our purposes. So who was the first guy? Well, according to me, the first guy to consider this was Louis Bachelier. And I noticed that Professor Bushel gave his full name. I can't remember Louis Bachelier's full name, but I remember he has Alphonse somewhere in the middle. Anyway, Louis Bachelier wrote a thesis in 1900, supervised by Henri Poincaré, the famous mathematician. And significantly, he probably almost definitely traded options. So what's the fair premium of an option? Well, the place to start is to look at put-call parity. What is put-call parity? It comes from this simple diagram. Imagine I buy an at-the-money option. It could be any strike. I buy an at-the-money option, at-the-money call option, and sell an at-the-money put option. And you can see, just adding these pictures in your head, you get a straight line. So in other words, plus a call minus a put is equal to being long the stock. So if I buy a call and sell a put and sell a stock, it's as if I had done nothing at all. This position is completely riskless. And you can convince yourself that this means that options should be priced as if expected returns were zero. I mean, ignoring finance and dividends. Financing is essentially zero these days anyway, and dividends are very small. This is even a good approximation. So you can convince yourself that basically expected returns should be zero. And in fact, on page 38 of his thesis, Bachelier writes, "En résumé, la considération des cours vrais permet d'énoncer un principe fondamental. L'espérance mathématique du spéculateur est nulle." In other words, you shouldn't expect to make money. The market trades, the option market trades, as if the expected return is zero. And his explanation is basically, there are buyers, they buy because they think the price is going up. There are sellers, they sell because they think the price is going down. And when you put them together, options are priced as if it's 50-50. Bachelet combined this assumption with the assumption that price moves are independent to effectively invent Brownian motion. And this was 5 years ahead of Einstein. Einstein was credited for the invention of Brownian motion, but he was 5 years ahead. He wrote down the theory correctly. He wrote down many different things. He had Foucault parity, for example, this thing that I just showed you here, which was a big confusion for people who didn't know his work. So in modern notation, his price process reads the following. DS, in other words, the change in the stock price, is given by some fixed price times sigma. Sigma is called the volatility. It's a measure of how much things move up and down, times this random walk. This process is known as arithmetic Brownian motion. It's a continuous process which is nowhere differentiable. So this is a cool thing for mathematicians. Mathematicians love these weird things. A continuous function that's nowhere differentiable. The constant sigma is known as volatility. And variance is directly proportional to the time interval. In fact, it's easy to show that if you have independent increments or even increments that are non-correlated, the variance of the price needs to be directly proportional to the time interval. And interestingly, Bachelier also wrote down an option pricing formula. So in a sense, he solved the entire problem. He started with a very simple principle, which came from this kind of observation here. He started with a very simple principle and ended up with a model. So now let's compare prices generated from the model with S&P. So here's S&P in 2015. Why 2015? Because it didn't go anywhere, so it makes it look more plausible. So you can see S&P going up and down. And here's a Bachelier fake series. And you can see the fake series looks pretty much like the real one. Okay. So in 1973, a full 73 years later than Bachelier's thesis, Black and Scholes published a paper with their famous formula. From a trader's perspective, this formula really didn't add anything to Bachelier's work. I mean, it solved some problems for economists, but traders are not economists. Black and Scholes used geometric rather than arithmetic Brownian motion, right? So rather than having a fixed price S naught in here, they had a moving price. So ds over s is proportional to sigma dw. Log returns over the interval are normally distributed with some standard deviation. So actually it makes sense to study log returns. As I showed you earlier on, it makes sense to look at log returns rather than returns. And the other nice thing is, in Bachelier's model, prices can go negative. The chance of them going negative, you can calculate it. It's like infinitesimal. Prices can go negative. So this was something that bothered people. But the key practical contribution of Black and Scholes' work was the realization that in the limit of continuous trading with no transaction cost, so obviously these are ridiculous ideas. You can't trade continuously. You know, your maximum trading frequency is probably like every few microseconds these days, and I'm sure it will get faster in the future. But, you know, you can't trade faster than the speed of light, so there's a physical limit on how fast you can trade. And no transaction costs, well, you can't trade without transaction costs. But in this theoretical limit, you could eliminate risk. So the following quote is from Black and Scholes' paper. Thus, the risk in the hedge position is zero if the short position in the option is adjusted continuously. If the position is not adjusted continuously, of course, as it's not in real life, the risk is small and consists entirely of risk that can be diversified away by forming a portfolio of a large number of such hedge positions. So when I started trading options professionally back in 1984, this is exactly what it did. This is a perfect description of what I was doing. I sell some options, I delta hedge them, I buy options, I delta hedge them, the net risk is small and diversified away. This was the insight that led to the phenomenal growth of the financial derivatives industry, and it ended up earning Robert Merton and Myron Scholes the Nobel Prize in Economics. Although to make Nassim Taleb happy, I should not call it the Nobel Prize in Economics. I call it the prize in the memory of Alfred Nobel, because it's not a proper Nobel Prize. Now, why Robert Merton and Myron Scholes and not Fisher Black and Myron Scholes? Well, because sadly, Fisher Black passed away before his time. So here's the formula. The fair price of a European call option with strike price capital K and time to expiration tau, when the stock price S&P is S, is given by Black-Scholes formula, S, K, tau, sigma, is S times N of D plus minus K times N of D minus. Well, what is N? N is the cumulative normal distribution function. So you can see here, it's a very simple function. It's a simple function of volatility and time to expiration and the strike price. Now, this formula doesn't only give the price, but it gives the sensitivity of the price with respect to model parameters. Well, it gives the sensitivity with respect to the stock price. So it tells you in principle how much stock you should put against your call and put options, whether you're long or short. And given that traders don't really trust this model, they know somehow the model has many assumptions that are not quite right, they also like to hedge against changes in volatility. So sensitivity to changes in volatility is called vega. And so basically traders will delta hedge, which is hedging with the stock, and vega hedge, which is hedging with other options. So according to this strategy, according to the delta hedging strategy, to hedge a short option position, you buy the stock after the stock price goes up and sell the stock after the price goes down. Now, doesn't this contradict everything you've ever heard about trading? You're meant to buy when the price goes down and sell when the price goes up. This is the way to make money. This sounds like a guaranteed way to lose money. Well, actually, it is a guaranteed way to lose money. Buying the stock after the price goes up and selling the stock after the price goes down. The cost of this strategy is the option premium. So that's how the theory all ties together. The cost of this money losing strategy is precisely the option premium that we showed in previous slides. Well, up until October the 19th, 1987, and of course I remember that day well, I didn't trade for about a week or 2 weeks after October the 19th, because there was no liquidity, the prices were crazy. But as I explained earlier, I had hedged. So I was hedged against movements in the spot, and I was hedged against movements in the volatility. And after a couple of weeks, I think I'd actually made a couple of $100,000, but I could have lost a couple of $100,000, but it was small amount of money. And, you know, up until that time, we were just using Black-Scholes. After this date, however, options were priced quite differently. Well, why? Well, let's look at what happened on Black Monday, October the 19th, 1987, that date that is etched into our collective memory. We see that the S&P, this is the whole index, not just individual stocks, but the entire index, fell by 23%. So you can calculate the probability for this to happen under Black-Scholes. One way to express it, it's a homework assignment for my students, is to calculate how long you would have to wait under Black-Scholes assumptions for a move of this to occur. And when you calculate it, it's longer than the life of the universe by a huge factor. So it's a perfect example of the theme of this lecture series. Interaction, rétroaction, and crise. It's a crisis. It came from the interaction between different traders, and it's a feedback effect. Why is a feedback effect? Well, it was caused by portfolio insurance. Option traders, delta hedging short put positions essentially, and following the delta hedging strategy that I explained before, as the market falls, you sell stock. As you sell stock, the market goes down. Now you have to sell more stock. The market falls further. Then you have to sell more, and the market falls further, and so on, until you get this horrible move. Now, according to the Black-Scholes model, the chance of S&P declining by 23% is zero. Zero to zero to any degree of accuracy, zero to however many decimal places. But clearly, options that were 23% out of the money were worth something. They weren't worth nothing. So you need a model that gives value to these options. What happened to traders? Well, traders who were long options, imagine you were long and out of the money option, according to Black-Scholes, is worth nothing. Because it's on your book, it's worth nothing, but suddenly you made a lot of money with this option. On the other hand, traders who were short options, they made gigantic losses. So the conclusion is, options had been mispriced, so these out-of-the-money options should be much more expensive, and they'd been mishedged, because if you were long an out-of-the-money option, according to Black-Scholes, its premium is zero, it should have no hedge against it whatsoever. And on the other hand, obviously it was worth something and you should have some hedge against it. So let's look at the data once again and ask ourselves whether the Black-Scholes model is reasonable. Well, according to the Black-Scholes model, the distribution of log return should be Gaussian. So here's the Gaussian distribution in red, and here is the true distribution of underlying returns, unconditional distribution. And we see it's very highly peaked, and we know it has very fat tails because we know at least one of the points was down 20%. So here is a graph of S&P daily returns. All I did was get data from Yahoo, you can do the same thing, and just plot the time series of daily returns. And well, what do we notice about this? Nothing much until we compare it with Black-Scholes. We notice Black-Scholes daily returns, they're basically just white noise. In fact, technically they're white noise. So we see every day the fluctuation is very similar, but we see in the true series, sometimes you get huge fluctuations and sometimes you get tiny fluctuations. And when you get huge fluctuations, they tend to be followed by huge fluctuations. So Mandelbrot was the guy who first said it. In other words, large changes tend to be followed by large changes of either sign, and small changes tend to be followed by small changes. So remember, Bachelier had assumed that price changes are independent, but we see from this picture that they're not independent. It's easy to show that they're quasi uncorrelated, but they're not independent. In other words, if you observe a very large change in the stock price or a very large change in S&P today, it is highly likely that the change will be very large tomorrow. And if you observe a very small change in the S&P today, it is highly likely that the change in S&P will be very small tomorrow. So volatility is a proxy for the magnitude of price changes. Volatility appears to be some kind of stochastic process, in other words, a random process in time. Now, according to econometricians, they're not traders, but they're clever people, so they have fancy techniques for measuring volatility from price data. So using one of these databases, which is actually from Oxford, that's using their estimates of a proxy for volatility squared, let's draw the picture. And we see, okay, so some days the volatility is very high, and other days the volatility is very low. And I've done it on a log scale because it turns out that volatility, the log of volatility, is roughly normal. We'll see this later. Another thing that we can tell just by using the same data here, this realized variance data, if we look at the correlation between price changes and volatility for various lags, we see that a negative price change has a big positive, well, okay, another way around putting it, a positive price change has a big negative effect on the volatility, but a negative change on the or a positive change on the volatility has no effect on the return. So we've got this kind of asymmetry in the price series that our model needs to take account of. And this effect is called the leverage effect for reasons that are kind of theoretical and probably not relevant to reality. So from 1987, options traders began to price options with stochastic volatility models. So what does such a model look like? Well, if you only read this line, it looks like the Black-Scholes model, except that now we've added a subscript little t to sigma to represent the fact that sigma t is now a random process. Well, we can see from our picture, it looks like sigma is a random process because this is a proxy for sigma. And so we write down some kind of dynamics for sigma. And the natural thing to do is, since we use Brownian motion for the stock price, let's use another Brownian motion for sigma. So we say d sigma is alpha dt plus beta dz. And alpha and beta, they can be complicated functions of various things. It's still a stochastic volatility model. So W and Z are negatively correlated Brownian motions. Why negatively correlated? Well, to capture this leverage effect. Volatility is modeled as a continuous stochastic process. In fact, it's modeled as a so-called semi-martingale. When volatility is high, there are large moves in either direction. And this is consistent with Mandelbrot's observation, which we can see here. Okay, there's no nice closed form formula for the option price in most stochastic volatility models. If there's one model called the Heston model, which where there is an almost closed form formula, but its dynamics are pretty unrealistic. So in general, we require numerical techniques. And of course, this is another reason why some traders actually study financial mathematics in programs such as ours. In the simplest case of a one-factor stochastic volatility model, options may be hedged using stock and one other option. So management of portfolios is conceptually no harder than before. It's just the same. You get given a model by your quantitative analyst. As a trader, you get given by a model by this guy that allows you, that tells you sensitivities to the underlying, it tells you sensitivity to volatility, and it allows you to cancel your sensitivities. And this is the way you manage your portfolio, just like before. And here I have superimposed the, some proxy for the unconditional distribution of volatility under log normal stochastic volatility. Log normal stochastic volatility is a model where beta here is just proportional to the volatility itself. And if I take such a model and simulate it, this is what I get. So you see, it seems I've kind of explained everything now. The Black-Scholes formula gives the fair value of a call option assuming volatility is constant. Well, we know it's not constant. So we can invert the market price of an option to get so-called implied volatility, like this. So the only parameter that's not known, you know the stock price, you know the strike price, you know the time to expiration. The only parameter you don't know is sigma. And so you take the market price of the option, which comes from these interactions between traders who now know about Black Monday. So they're not pricing with the Black-Scholes model anymore. So They are prices that come from taking into account the risk of losing huge amounts of money if there's a large move. They are all incorporated into this function, sigma. Fixing time to expiration, the graph of sigma Black-Scholes implied volatility is known as the volatility smile. Now, remember, this is a feature of options markets that's generated by trading. It does not come from any model. It does not come from any stochastic volatility model. It's generated by traders trading options. They don't need us to teach them how to trade. Birds don't need to be taught how to fly. Well, maybe their parents teach them how to fly, but scientists don't teach them how to fly. Almost all stochastic volatility models generate prices consistent with individual volatility smiles. However, if you put all the smiles together, it turns out they're not so consistent. So here's a typical S&P volatility smile from the last whole day of trading that's in my data set. I'm not allowed to see recent data, so this is the last day. And you can see that the implied volatility goes up. I believe it goes up forever, but we can't see. So it goes up a lot for low strikes. Okay, and here, putting all 35 slices together, all 35 slices in the volatility surface together, we get this beautiful picture here. This is a graph of the S&P volatility surface as of 30th of December. So this volatility surface has remained approximately the same shape since 1987. Up until 1987 and that horrible event, the vol surface was approximately flat, but now it has this beautiful shape. However, until recently, no simple stochastic volatility model was able to reproduce this simple-looking shape. Now, this is a real problem for option traders because they need accurate models that are consistent with the time series to minimize pricing errors and optimize hedges. So using their stochastic volatility models, if they hedge according to the sensitivities given by these stochastic volatility models, they're going to hedge movements according to a model that generates a vol surface that's a different shape from this thing. So naturally, if they had a better model, they might be able to reduce their hedging errors. So there's another thing wrong with traditional stochastic volatility models. Assuming that paths of the stock price and paths of the volatility are continuous, which is an assumption, by the way. Some people disagree with these things. Some people think the paths of the stock price and the paths of the volatility are jumpy. I hate that assumption, but one can assume these things. We're going to assume they're continuous. A good approximation for this expected variance number is updated in real time. And taking the square root of this thing, you get the VIX index. VIX stands for volatility index. Many of you have probably read about the volatility index. It's called the fear index sometimes in journalist articles. It shoots up every time there's a big shock to the market. Now let's look at the VIX time series, and we can probably recognize what these peaks are. As I said, the VIX shoots up every time there's some kind of panic in the market. Well, this is the financial crisis. This is the collapse of Lehman. And what is this one? Well, I'm sure this is etched into everybody's recent memory. This is the COVID crisis. So let's compare VIX with the realized variance measure, this proxy for volatility that is available from Oxford, and we see, well, they look almost like the same picture. In other words, VIX looks qualitatively like realized variance. When you trade VIX, you're basically trading volatility. It's much more complicated to trade, but it's like trading implied volatility. And as I mentioned earlier, sensitivity to implied volatility is called Vega, a Greek letter that doesn't exist. Since 2013, in fact, more Vega has been traded in VIX options and futures than in S&P options, which are still, S&P is still the world's biggest equity options market. We can easily compute VIX implied volatility and the VIX volatility surface because we're just traders here. VIX is just another underlying that can be traded like everything else. So here's a VIX volatility smile. You see it's completely different from S&P volatility smile. S&P volatility smile is reflecting two things. First of all, it's reflecting the fact that we don't know where volatility is going to do. This is why it goes up in both wings. On the other hand, it's also reflecting that if the stock price goes down a lot, the volatility will go up a lot, right? That's the leverage effect. Now, on the other hand, the VIX smile is telling us that the risks in VIX are all shooting up. You will get this, you will see the same kind of effect in gold. The risks to gold are always massive increases in the gold price. The risk is not that the gold price is going to fall. If it falls, it falls gently and it always shoots up. And we can graph the vol surface again, and we see it's a completely different shape from the S&P volatility surface. Okay, now if we have a stochastic volatility model, and it's a good one, it should be able to model S&P and VIX consistently, because VIX is, after all, just volatility of S&P. Well, it turns out there is no such model. And this is another proof, if any proof was needed, that market prices don't come from any model. These are features of the market. These features of the market result from trading, and they don't come from any particular model. Now, there's one particular statistic of the vol surface, this particular vol surface here. We go back to the picture and we look at the slope of the vol surface at the money. We get this beautiful picture here. And we see it's almost perfectly matched by our power law, 1 over tau to the 0.37. And it's a fact that conventional stochastic volatility models don't match this skew. Now, there's a theoretical idea that was first introduced by Alice and her co-authors, and then picked up again by Fukasawa. They showed that the power law skew could be generated by a stochastic volatility model where volatility is a function of fractional Brownian motion rather than Brownian motion. So recall that in a conventional stochastic volatility model, we just stuck in a Brownian motion because we thought, well, you know, stock price is a Brownian motion. Why shouldn't volatility be a Brownian motion? So they showed that if you put in a fractional Brownian motion, you generate this kind of skew. Now, in order for such a model to offer a realistic description of the historical time series, this time series would have to exhibit scaling properties consistent with fractional Brownian motion. Well, looking at it, looking at the same plot that we showed before, you see actually this plot is very rough compared to Brownian motion. Recall that the variance of Brownian motion scales is directly proportional to time to expiration. Let's check the constant of proportionality for the log of vol. And we see, okay, we get the straight lines, this is good. But then when we look at the scaling says that basically volatility of volatility, if you want to look like that, it scales as delta to the zeta of the q, zeta of q. Zeta of q is q times h, where h is not a half. The h is basically 0.17, so it's very tiny compared to Brownian motion. So this estimate of h is probably biased high. We believe more like h, 0.1, whatever. Now, interestingly, the unique continuous Gaussian process with the scaling property is fractional Brownian motion. So lots of assumptions here. I believe in continuous processes, other people may not believe, and so on and so on. But if you bear with me and you say that this H is a constant and that we've got Gaussian returns, which we have, log sigma of t looks like fractional Brownian motion. Now, if we generate, now we look at realized variance plot from Oxford and we compare it with our fractional Brownian motion equivalent, hey, they look the same. So again, we're looking at a much more subtle properties of the underlying price series, but we've now found a model that seems to give similar properties. Very interestingly, Mathieu Rosenbaum, who's at Ecole Polytechnique, and his co-authors found that you can generate this kind of model by considering microstructure, a very simple microstructure where the price goes up if you buy and the price goes down if you sell. Well, so far so good. And because you can only buy a certain amount each time you buy, because there's insufficient liquidity, you need to split your order. And the way the order is split, and the fact that, you know, sales have more impact than buys and so on, putting all this together, you get, and cleverly rescaling this very simple process, leads to a rough stochastic volatility model. In fact, it's a natural generalization of the Heston model, the rough Heston model. And in fact, later, Mathieu and his PhD student, Paul Juslin, they generalized the above by arguing that rough volatility is a direct consequence of no arbitrage plus the existence of market impact. Well, you know, it's a very rough argument, but philosophically, I'm sure there's something to it. And well, this is new research. We're still waiting for the final word on these things. Now, of course, I've talked about option traders and how these fancier models of the underlying was driven by option trading, which I truly believe. I truly believe that the real industrial reason why this research was done is to improve the management of, make the management of option portfolios more efficient. And now, an example of a different kind of research is the kind of research done at CFM by Professor Bouchot and his colleagues. They spend many years studying directly the time series of prices, probably, maybe because they trade options, but I suspect because they want to better manage their portfolios, their complex portfolios of financial assets. And they showed that, in fact, rather than a Hawkes model, which was used, a linear Hawkes model, which was used by Mathieu Rosenbaum in his rough Heston model, quadratic Hawkes processes offer surprisingly good descriptions of the dynamics of financial prices. Also coming at this from a different perspective again, Julien Guillon has suggested that only explicitly path-dependent models that we didn't talk about here are capable of describing the joint dynamics of S&P and VIX. So these are stochastic volatility models that take a different form from the one that we wrote down before. So first of all, the linear model that rough Heston model is, the linear Hawkes model is unreasonable. Log normal dynamics are more reasonable, and we showed that kind, or we gave some evidence for that when we showed the unconditional distribution of returns. So inspired by the work of Bouchot, Mathieu and I proposed the quadratic rough Heston model. The quadratic rough Heston process is approximately log normal. It's explicitly path dependent. So this is responding to Julien Guillon. Variance is a weighted function of the price path. Moreover, it appears that we solved more or less by accident, because Paul Juslin was basically playing around with the numerical simulation of this model. They said, wow, it seems to fit the S&P and the VIX. So here are some S&P smiles as of the 19th of May 2017, which was the day we looked at in our paper. And we see, okay, the S&P smiles seem to be matched more or less well, and the VIX smiles are even matched. So this is kind of incredible, because it's a very, very simple model. In fact, this model is crazy, too crazy simple, and it seems to match VIX and S&P, and it's motivated by these discoveries of Professor Bouchot and Julien Guyon. So it's like too good to be true. And more work to be has to be done to understand the details of this model, to understand how to trade with it, and so on and so forth. It's too simple for sure. So in summary, the complex dynamics of financial prices emerge from the interactions between many thousands of traders. It's nothing to do with option modeling. When we do option modeling, we're trying to understand this dynamics that comes from trading. The nature of these dynamics is still to be completely understood and may never be. Why may it never be understood? Well, because as we increase our understanding, we're going to improve our models and we're going to see ever more subtle details of the dynamics of financial prices that still need to be understood. The market pricing of options gives us sophisticated guidance towards a better understanding. As our understanding improves and leads to better risk management, spreads should, in principle, decline further, and more fascinating patterns and prices will likely emerge. So there will always be work for us, or work for our students, or work for our students' students, I believe. So here are some references, and at this point, I'm very happy to take questions if there are any questions.
Beautiful, Jim. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This will give us supplementary information to what I've talked about in my own lecture. And I think it's great. So if I may abuse the chair, I have a few questions, but
sure.
Of course others will ask questions later if they want. So first of all, just a clarification. It seems to me that you flip-flop a little bit between option prices being the primary objects and underlying being the primary object. For me, the underlying dynamics is the primary object, and option prices may or may not reveal the subtlety of the underlying prices. And if option do not reveal the same regularities, then there is a statistical arbitrage signal.
Okay.
To finish on that, because we know that option prices can have biases because of this interaction between many traders. They can, you know, systematically misprice options and be not compatible with an underlying that you can observe directly. And actually, what you show is that you have the whole construction of the Rough Volatility Model relies on the underlying.
Correct. So I remember when I don't think these questions are going to appear in the final recording, so we can speak freely here.
Well, you can keep them if you think they're interesting.
Them, but yeah.
I think they might be interesting for the audience.
Ah, okay. So maybe then we have to ask this again to change the recording. But anyway, when we first submitted the paper, the Rough Volatility paper, some of the referees were incredulous that there would ever be agreement between option market and the underlying. In other words, they assumed what you're also assuming, that option prices would be highly biased and inconsistent with the dynamics of the underlying. And my guiding principle in this work was that you could use options as experimental tools, because basically people are already doing the trading that you described. In other words, if there are statistical arbitrages between options and the underlying, people are doing this already and driving options towards their fair prices.
Well,
so
that's where we disagree, because because I know that option pricing has been biased for 15 years, and they're not going to, I mean, that we don't see any convergence to fair pricing.
Well,
there are systematics that don't disappear, even in prices themselves, actually, without going to options.
Right. All right. So then this is a different philosophical perspective. That's all I can say. And I should say, you know better, because you've been making money at CFM for a long time from these arbitrages. But then you don't always make money. You don't make money every day.
No. Statistical arbitrage.
Yeah, the statistical arbitrage. And you know, we probably, well, I mean, I think this is this thing is really unanswerable. In
No,
other
but
words,
Jim, make no mistake, I agree that there is a big part of the true underlying that's reflected by option prices. But I don't think one can assume, from a kind of scientific point of view, I don't think that one can assume a priori that all the subtleties of the true underlying will be reflected in option prices.
okay, so let's say it this way. Suppose one takes the philosophically naive perspective that option prices are consistent with the underlying because there are an infinite number of traders arbitraging away all statistical arbitrages. In that case, you could use options as experimental tools to study the underlying.
I agree.
And I agree with your point that there are statistical anomalies in the underlying, and there are statistical anomalies in option pricing. But if one takes that point of view, that crazy naive philosophical point of view, it turns out to be a very fruitful one. Can we agree on that?
Yes. No, I agree. It's just as I was saying, it's a point of clarification. And I think that too often people, believe in strict arbitrage and think that option prices and underlying are kind of equivalent.
So
But
the
they aren't.
one thing that I do emphasize in this lecture that you likely agree with is that the prices of options have nothing to do with models.
Yes. Sure. And so my other point was you said rather funnily that you hate jumps. But I would say, like Galileo, et pur, it jumps. I mean, if you see a 8 sigma event on a 1 minute time scale that occurs, kind of frequently, because in the end, these events happen all the time, how do you call them if they're not jumps?
Well, again, it's a matter of philosophy. I remember having an argument with other quants a long time ago, and they were saying, how can you not believe in jumps? Well, the point is, we only observe the underlying process at discrete intervals. And let's go to the extreme and imagine we observe the market every microsecond. Well, actually, with a rough volatility process, the market can move a lot in a microsecond. Basically, it's a superposition of traditional processes on many different timescales. And you have a super high volatility process with super high mean reversion
Yes.
that can give you something happening on a
Sure.
timescale of 1 microsecond. So I don't see any
Well,
reason why it can be a continuous. In fact, it's impossible to tell whether it's a continuous or a jump process.
okay, so let me say it another way. I mean, we've tried that. If you take the best volatility model you have, like the rough volatility model or the quadratic Hawkes model or whatever, and you calibrate it to reality as best
Yes.
as you can, and then you kind of measure the return divided by the best prediction of your volatility, you still find tails, you still find 4 sigma
Right,
events.
right, right. And many people have told me the same thing. But the question is, what's the weight in these tails? And
No,
okay,
I
I
mean, it's
say I
clearly
hate jumps.
significant.
I have to admit that jumps probably exist, but they are extremely rare.
Well, I don't really agree. And actually, I think it's a very important point because you said models, they're important for, improving risk control for option traders and so on. But I think models have another purpose, which is to understand very important issues like market stability. And I think jumps are related to the lack of market stability.
Oh, okay, but it can also be rough volatility is related to the lack of market stability, right? I think
Yes.
it's impossible to tell the difference. It's impossible to tell the difference. So I have had this discussion with people many times. So they say, okay, I believe in jumps. All right, it's your philosophical point of view. I can't find any argument that says there are no jumps, right? So you can believe in jumps, and I can believe there are no jumps. And our processes are both consistent with the underlying time series. However, if you try to use jump models to calculate option prices, for example, what are you going to do? Well, the way it's normally done is with levy processes with independent increments, and
Oh no, that's no good.
that obviously no good, right? So you're going to use a Hawkes process or something, right? Something with self-exciting jumps, because you have to respond to Mandelbrot's observation that large moves follow large moves and small moves follow small moves. You have to respond to that. And so you have a self-exciting jump process that says when there's a large jump, there are going to be more large jumps, and so on and so forth. Now you have so many parameters to deal with, because you're going to say, oh, well, my Hawkes process is not sufficiently realistic. I have to make it more realistic, and so on and so forth. People have tried to do this. They have tried to make, for example, the Heston model more realistic by having by basically make it making the underlying process Hawkes style self-exciting jump process. You can't do anything with this. So the rough volatility paradigm, for whatever reason, we don't really understand why, but for whatever reason, it's a very simple way of looking at things that seems to agree with the dynamics of market prices and automatically generates this clustering of jumps, if you want to call it that,
No,
and even magnitudes.
I totally agree with the fact that there's a lot of the dynamics that's captured by the rough volatility model. I totally agree with that. And again, I'm quibbling a little bit on the details, but I think that jumps are specific events that happen in stock markets, and that they're very important because they reveal something going on in the liquidity
Right.
of the, of these
Yeah.
markets. And you know, philosophically again, or as a physicist, I can't see how a rough volatility model would capture the essence of these events. And so, yes, I agree, this would make a much more complicated model. But if you're interested in market stability, I think that the inspiration that these jumps are specific events that must be modeled as per se
Well, you know,
is quite important.
if it's a specific event, how do you model it? So if you're doing risk management, obviously you want to stick in a jump of some sort. You want to say, what happens if there is a really extreme event that's not in my model? But if you're modeling and just managing your portfolio from day to day, wouldn't rough volatility be the right way to go?
But if you're a market regulator and want to understand why markets jump, then you should have a model that describes the possible origin of these jumps. And actually, it's going to be my a little bit what I'm going to address in
All
lecture
right, so
three.
I'm fascinated to see what you're going to say about that.
Okay.
Okay, if I
So thank
can,
you. I'm
yes,
done.
great. No, you know, just to continue to build on your work, and especially, you know, I think that also in terms of what we believe a model should do, when you see these power laws as we see within the rough volatility model, it's interesting because we know that these usually appears together with universality and the way we understand in physics the model, the notion of fixed point, which is very different from what is currently considered a modeling approach in standard economics and finance. So do you think that, you know, how do you comment on the emergence of these? We know that from empirical data we observe some universality. So there are some regularities that witness that we should have a more robust definition of a model let's say, for this data and so on. So I'm asking to Jim to comment on universality, on the robustness, and to Jean-Philippe
Yeah.
to build on that from his physicist Yeah. achievements.
So honestly, Claudio, to me this is a mystery, and I'm going to punt. I'm going to hand the question to Jean-Philippe, who's after all a condensed matter guy, a spin glass guy, so he deals with phase transitions all the time and power law decay of this and that and the other thing. So Jean-Philippe, what do you have to say? I think it's the most fascinating and important problem to solve, actually. And we don't have an answer to that question. We have empirical observations that show a surprising degree of universality, I agree. I mean, as you say, this H value for rough volatility seems to be pretty universal. The description of the parallel tails of the return distribution is surprisingly the same for CDSs, implied volatility, underlyings. I mean, there's no reason for this to happen a priori. So we need to understand why, as you say, thousands of traders interacting kind of conspire to build something that's maybe on the verge of some critical point of unknown origin. Of course, people have looked for an explanation, but I don't think for the moment we have anything convincing that would, make the rough volatility model emerge spontaneously with a value of H, which in principle should be computed from first principles. Why not?
Right.
But I think it's a fantastically important problem.
And I think that this is really a contribute. We have here two of the main contributors highlighting the relevance of this topic, of this necessity of a new class of, let's say, of a new philosophical approach to modeling that is still, poorly understood for the big audience in the economics and finance literature. Because, by the way we approach regulation, the way we approach model risk would require better understanding. So we hope for your future contributions to continue along this
Or
great
of our students.
Well, sure.
Yeah,
Yes.
that's right. We bequeath the problems to our students. That's a great way to finish, I think.
Well, thank
Great.
you so much, Jim. It was
Thank you.
fantastic. And
Thank you very much.
I hope we can see each other soon in real.